All right. So I'll be giving a fairly brief overview of the problem of retaining neutron stars and globular clusters. And by retaining, I mean retaining them from very early times in the cluster evolution so that they can participate in all the fancy few-body dynamics that produce the interesting things that we see. This is a fairly unsophisticated talk, but I at least hope to convince you that it's a rich problem and ties into topics on stellar evolution, on the early formation of globular clusters and the early dynamical evolution, as well as I already mentioned, the interesting dynamical processes that produce the abundance and variety of things that we see in globular clusters, at least insofar as neutron stars are concerned. So I'm just going to start off by very briefly summarizing some of the things that we see in clusters. Of course, we already had some fantastic talks this morning on millisecond pulsars, and we had some talks yesterday on X-ray sources and globular clusters, so I don't need to spend too much time on the specifics of either of these. The neutron stars we see in globular clusters are seen, of course, in X-ray and radio wavelengths primarily. The X-ray sources come in two varieties. There are the classic dozen or so bursting, fairly luminous, some even persistent X-ray sources in globular clusters. There are the much larger numbers and much more widespread low luminosity X-ray sources in globular clusters, many of which may be neutron stars, possibly millisecond radio pulsars that are seen in X-rays, in some case alleged millisecond radio pulsars that are only seen in X-rays, as well as quiescent LMXBs. There's pretty good evidence that we see both classes of objects. 47 Tuck, of course, stands out in the low luminosity X-ray source category as having more than 100 detected low luminosity sources, according to Josh Grinley and collaborators, and I think he'll be elaborating on this tomorrow. 47 Tuck also stands out as having 20 or more, or more than 20, I think 22 millisecond radio pulsars, about half of which are binary, and the majority of which are also detected in soft X-rays. I think there are roughly, it's been a while since I've actually checked these numbers, they change pretty rapidly. I think there are roughly 10 globular clusters now with two or more pulsars detected, and twice that number with at least one pulsar detected. And from the talks this morning, it's pretty clear that these objects are difficult to detect. We're near the sensitivity limits, and we're only really seeing the tip of the iceberg in regard to the pulsar population. Fernando Camilo said something definite this morning in terms of 47 Tuck and predicting that there are probably an order of magnitude more pulsars that remain to be detected that are below the sensitivity limits. And just very generally, these things are difficult to see, and it's likely that if we see one or if we see several, even if we see none, there are probably many more in the cluster that we can't see. And that's not to say that there aren't other neutron star varieties that we can't see. There are probably neutron stars in the cluster that have never been spun up, that would never be observable in any wavelength. There are probably neutron stars tied up in double neutron star binaries in globular clusters that may never be seen as gravity waves, that never be seen in gravity waves, even with an incredibly sensitive gravity wave detector that works. When we run through the theory, some of the formation theories and the channels for forming these different kinds of objects dynamically, we find that the formation probabilities are fairly low. Just generically speaking, we need a large pool of single neutron stars to participate in the 2-, 3-, and 4 body dynamical interactions that produce the abundance and variety of things that we see in clusters. And just as a very, I think, reasonable estimate for the kind of numbers that we need, I would suggest that we need roughly 1,000 neutron stars to start with in the richest globular clusters where we see the interesting things. And if we take a million solar mass cluster and we fold that with some reasonable initial mass function, the 1,000 neutron stars translates to a retention fraction in excess of 10 or 20%. And just as a characteristic minimum, I think that we probably need to keep at least 10% of the neutron stars that are initially formed in the cluster at least for a few billion years so that they can participate in the interesting dynamical interactions that produce the things we see. So, I'm going to now state the retention problem, at least the retention problem as I see it, don't take anything on this plot too literally. I have a lot of words to add to it. From the isolated radio pulsars in the galaxy, we infer, based on their proper motions and their approximate distances, speeds, translational speeds, of in excess, typically, of 1 to 200 kilometers per second. So several hundred kilometers per second seems like a typical neutron star speed. We also do not see very many neutron stars, or at least we don't see evidence for very many neutron stars with low speeds, speeds less than or border 50 kilometers per second. Now, the data on pulsar proper motions is fairly sparse, and it's difficult to analyze and fold in all the selection effects and systematics and things, but one can postulate, at least, a reasonable distribution for the kick speeds as a place to start, if nothing else. And if there really is a scarcity of neutron stars at low speeds and a peak in the speed distribution at several hundred kilometers per second, then a reasonable model is something like a Maxwellian. This has been used more out of convention than anything else. It's simple, it's parameterized by a single number, and it roughly models what we think we're seeing. Now, if we take this distribution, not even this distribution specifically, but these typical speeds, and what we think we know about neutron star kicks, I should have said earlier that these speeds for isolated radio pulsars are often interpreted as being due to natal kicks, kicks that the neutron star receives at the time of the supernova explosion, probably due to some asymmetry in the core collapse and the explosion itself, possibly neutrinos or other hydrodynamical mechanisms. If we take these speeds seriously and we compare them to the central escape speeds for the globular clusters we see today, there's a clear problem. In fact, if we take this distribution literally and we adopt a central escape speed, a fairly optimistic central escape speed of 50 kilometers per second, then what we find is that the number of neutron stars retained that are born from single progenitors is generally less than or of order a percent. If you take my estimate, my required minimum of 10% seriously, then this falls seriously short of what at least I suspect we need in order to produce the variety of things that we see. Well, as I said, these retention fractions of less than a percent apply to single progenitors. So let me investigate now let me summarize what I think happens if a neutron star is born with a binary companion. I'm focusing more on the stellar evolution side of the retention problem, but there certainly are dynamical issues and cluster structure issues that tie into this, which I'll get to in a bit. So, here is just a quick summary of the relevant binary issues. It's pretty clear that if a neutron star is born with a companion, and the more massive the better, the companion will act as an anchor, both to hold the neutron star onto the companion and ultimately to retain the neutron star in the cluster. Druckier, and in a paper by Davies and Hansen, these authors suggested that binaries may alleviate the retention problem. And in order to really quantitatively assess the importance of binaries, and in order to identify the most important channels for retaining neutron stars, this has to be done in a fairly systematic fashion. That is, investigate the binary retention problem using some reasonably serious prescriptions for treating binary evolution, binary formation, and ultimately the supernova explosion and the neutron star kick. So this essentially is assuming that the retention problem is one of stellar evolution rather than stellar dynamics. So that's the starting point for this investigation. And just to elaborate a little bit on how one carries out these kinds of calculations, I'm assuming very standard prescriptions for the binary population, something that's quite consistent with what we see in the galactic field. This is more out of ignorance than anything. I have no reason to believe that distributions of primordial binaries and globular clusters should differ too substantially, but there certainly is dependence on the formation environment. But this is a rough starting point for this kind of investigation, and it's probably the most reasonable place to start, or at least just as reasonable as anything else one could come up with. The primary mass, the more massive components drawn from a power law IMF, the secondary mass is drawn from a flat distribution and mass ratios, the semi-major axis of the primordial binary is drawn from a distribution that's flat and the logarithm of the semi-major axis. Next to the neutron star kick and the supernova that accompanies it, the most important decision to make is whether or not the mass transfer in this massive primordial binary system is stable or dynamically unstable. Just as, for instance, we have a 10 or 15 solar mass primary, the neutron star progenitor, and the secondary mass is unconstrained. I mean, it could be a 5 solar mass. It could likewise be a massive star. And we have to decide, given the evolutionary state at which the star fills its Roche lobe and the mass ratio, whether that mass transfer is stable or dynamically unstable. And almost by definition, stable mass transfer is characterized by a relatively modest change in the orbital separation. And the secondary in these systems have a chance to accrete a significant fraction of the material donated by the primary, the envelope of the primary, the hydrogen-rich envelope. On the other hand, for dynamically unstable mass transfer, the orbital separation can decrease by a factor of 100 or more, and it seems pretty likely that the secondary accretes very little during this phase. This is the common envelope phase, where the secondary spirals in to the envelope of this bloated primary star. I assume, for simplicity, the secondary actually accretes absolutely nothing during this phase. So you can see there's a pretty dramatic difference between these two. We have this dramatic orbital shrinkage in the common envelope phase that increases the orbital speed by a factor of 100 or more. And the secondary, if it's initially low mass, will remain low mass. And of course, after the mass transfer, we have to compute what happens with the supernova and the kick. In either case, if a merger is avoided, mergers are most likely to occur for the common envelope case and not as likely for the stable mass transfer case, although it's still a possibility in principle. I assume that what remains is the core of the primary, typically 3 to 5 solar masses. It may be pre-helium ignition, it may be post-helium ignition, depending on the initial orbital separation before mass transfer. This core of the primary will consume its remaining nuclear fuel and explode as a type 1b or 1c supernova. There will be impulsive mass loss. Several solar masses will be ejected from the system very quickly, and the neutron star will likely receive some natal kick at the time that it's formed. As I said before, possibly due to some asymmetry in the supernova explosion. So let me just try to, using some semi-quantitative hand-wavy arguments, try to convince you why stable mass transfer is the most profitable channel for retaining neutron stars in globular clusters. I have some rough numbers here for the outcomes. Companion masses following stable mass transfer in these massive primordial binaries are typically greater than or of order 10 solar masses. These are massive stars in themselves that follow the mass transfer. Orbital speeds, due to this sort of modest orbital contraction that results from the stable mass transfer, orbital speeds are typically in the range 1 to 200 kilometers per second. These are comparable to or even less than the kick speeds that I'm assuming in these simulations. So one would expect that certainly a significant fraction will be disrupted as a result of the kick, but likewise a significant fraction will remain bound after the kick. And that's very important because one can show that the small fractional mass loss in the supernova translates roughly into a center of mass speed for the binary system if it's bound following supernova. And just as a very rough estimate, we can take something like the 20% fractional mass loss that's typical in these systems, multiply it by the orbital speed to get speeds less than or border 50 kilometers per second, and that then is the center of mass speed of the binary after the explosion, and that speed is going to determine whether or not the system is retained in the cluster. And so for many of these systems, the speeds of the binary system following the explosion will be small enough to allow the whole system to be retained in the cluster. So both the binary companion as well as the neutron star are retained. And so these are the rough reasons why the stable mass transfer channel, where one ends up with a massive companion and relatively moderate relative orbital speeds, these are the reasons why these systems are the most profitable, provide the most profitable channel for retaining neutron stars. Just to be a bit more quantitative, I can show you a plot of some of the results of these simulations. If you can't read all the labels in here, I have some quick summaries on the side. The retention fractions, the 5, the 8, the 15, and the 30, correspond to binary channels alone. From the curves here, if you can see them, the thin curves are for single neutron stars, that is, born from single progenitors. The thick curves are for neutron stars born in binaries. In all cases, the binary retention channels dominate over the single stars. So that immediately says that the binaries are at least an important consideration for retaining neutron stars. And here I have a range of this sigma parameter that appears in the Maxwellian. For sigma of 200, which is not inconsistent with the data on pulsar proper motions, the retention fraction due to binaries might range from 5 to 8% for central escape speeds of 50 to 100 kilometers per second, and the retention fraction might range from 15 to 30%, much better numbers, for a sigma of 100. Again, not inconsistent with the data on pulsar proper motions. I should also add that I'm parameterizing the cluster structure in a very simple way by a single number, that is the central escape speed, so that the numbers I'm effectively assuming that all the stars and binaries are infinitely concentrated at the center of the cluster. So the numbers I'm actually computing are probably somewhat optimistic. It's not necessarily true that they're very optimistic, because one would expect that perhaps the mass of binaries and things that I'm considering are concentrated towards the center of the cluster. I've tried putting in more realistic models for the cluster structure, a Plummer model for simplicity, and the numbers don't change dramatically, at most by a factor of 2 or 3, but in the optimistic direction, so that these numbers are probably decreased by a factor of 2 or 3 if one includes details about the structure of the cluster. So there is a caveat to all of this binary business, which I'll get to in a minute. But now I'm just going to, this is my final view graph, I have a very small number of view graphs. I'm just going to briefly summarize some of the possible resolutions, two of which here I haven't mentioned, but which tie in to the caveat that I alluded to a few seconds ago. I split the possible resolutions to the retention problem into two categories, ones that involve stellar evolution, having to do either with the supernova explosion or binary stellar evolution or single star evolution, and those having to do with the cluster structure, the structure of the cluster at early times when the massive stars are exploding supernovae and when the neutron stars are being formed. Of course, in the stellar evolution category, one can alleviate all these problems by simply saying that, well, the speeds we infer for isolated pulsars are wrong, that the speeds are significantly less than we assume. This is still a matter of debate. It's not clear what the situation is. Right now, it appears not to be the case, that the pulsars we're measuring seem to be roughly consistent with what we think should be, well, not so much what we think which should be happening. We don't know what should be happening. But people have analyzed the pulsar proper motion data a number of times and find that typical speeds are in excess of 100 or 200 kilometers per second. If you like the binary channel for retaining neutron stars, then I can give you more if low-kick neutron stars are preferentially born in binary systems. This ties into another piece of work I did with Philip Podzolowski and Saul Rappaport, postulating, based upon a fairly conspicuous class of high-mass extra binaries, that the neutron star kick may be correlated with binary stellar evolution. We proposed a physical model for this, but it was all purely phenomenological. But nonetheless, I think there's fairly compelling evidence that some low-kick neutron stars are preferentially born in binary systems and would therefore be bound to their companions at the time of the supernova. And this enhances the retention fraction. If one includes the phenomenological scenario I developed for this work, and folds that into the retention simulation, then it brings the retention numbers up by a factor of 3 or 4, something like that. So certainly in the right direction and quite dramatically. However, there's a reason not necessarily to buy into all this business about binary retention, and that's because it's not clear what happens to these objects. It's not clear what happens to the neutron star in these massive binary systems that are retained in the cluster. What will happen, quite inevitably, is that the neutron star once this secondary, which is now the most massive object in the binary system, once the secondary, which is massive, overflows its Roche lobe, the neutron star has no choice but to spiral into the envelope. And in many cases, the neutron star will sink right to the core, right to the center of the star, and will sit there, and this will then be a Thorne-Zhidkov object, a neutron star core, and possibly a large red supergiant envelope. This is essentially inevitable. It's not clear what happens in this phase. I shouldn't say inevitable, but certainly in the majority of cases. It's not clear what happens in this phase. If the envelope is dispersed in this red supergiant wind that probably accompanies the Thorne-Zhidkov object evolution, then the neutron star may be left, possibly mildly recycled after accreting a small amount of material, or the neutron star may accrete enough material to collapse to a black hole. And if, for instance, 5 to 10 years from now, in doing these kinds of TZO simulations that people have done in the past, we find that all neutron stars collapse to black holes, well, then this binary retention channel doesn't work, and we have to look elsewhere. Well, maybe the kick speeds are lower, that's one possibility I also mentioned, or maybe the cluster structure is different than what I assume. One set of assumptions that people typically consider when imagining the retention problem is that the cluster parameters we see today are a good represent or provide a good set of representative numbers for what the clusters looked like at early times. This, of course, doesn't need to be the case. The clusters may have been much more massive and they may have been much more concentrated. However, I don't think you can quite, you have to, in some sense, pick one. If we take a million solar mass globular cluster and give it a central escape speed of 100 kilometers per second, that seems a bit unlikely to me. That's a very high central concentration. However, we can have a more modest central concentration if we increase the mass of the cluster by a factor of 10. It's pretty, I think, pretty clear, especially from some of the talks we heard on Monday, that the globular cluster sample we have in the Milky Way is a special sample. These are clusters that have survived in the Milky Way for whatever reason, and perhaps there were 10 times as many clusters to begin with. Well, it's probably a combination of things. It probably has to do with the initial mass function and the concentration and the mass. It's not clear. But one possible way for overcoming this retention problem is to postulate that in addition to having a fairly high concentration, the clusters were initially 10 times more massive generically. That is, for at least the richest clusters that we see today. This helps the retention problem in a number of ways. Certainly, if the cluster is concentrated, we expect to retain more neutron stars. But if the cluster is much more massive, we make many more neutron stars. And so if we can hold on to the tenfold increase in the number of neutron stars, we can be satisfied with a smaller retention fraction in the end. So that maybe 1% is okay if we started out with 10,000 neutron stars as opposed to 1,000 neutron stars, or 100,000 instead of 10,000. So that's another possibility, which I suggest pretty seriously. And on that note, I'm going to stop and take questions.
Josh, microphone, please.
Can't talk without the mic.
Eric, there's something that I've just occurred to me, but it must have occurred to others before. Fred or somebody may have thought of this. Mm-hmm. This whole, you know, nice channel, which I agree must work at some level to make them all in binaries, that's clearly, you know, it must be happening in the field, it certainly would happen in globulars, has a special hook in clusters. You put this massive, these are massive binaries by definition to begin with, in the 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7 years that these binaries get to do their thing before they, you know, catch their neutron stars.
Sure.
This massive subcore of binaries will collapse.
Possibly.
And you'll get some version of core collapse, you know, this mm-hmm. very uneven mass distribution.
That's right.
That will disrupt these very binaries, or at least a good fraction of them, if our picture
right.
of what halts core collapse. So the whole process has its own built-in destruct mechanism.
Yeah, that's
which is independent of cluster mass as well.
That's right. That's also possible.
You've got 10 of the 7 years. Anyway, this is the...
Yeah, go ahead. No, you finish your statement. Yeah.
So, you know, this I think is a problem, and, you know, we've got to consider it. So we may still need, you know, mechanisms like AIC or other ways to do this.
It's a
big question.
Yeah. But the issue of destruction is a serious one. Also, as Melvin just mentioned, the lifetime is a consideration as well. These are all very difficult problems. And I'm not sure we'll come to any clear consensus for what's actually going on.
Well, I think speaking for Melvin and myself, I would guess an answer to Josh's, I mean, you're right if for most binaries, but if you're going to have supernovae go off, you've got a very short clock to fight, and I don't think things would disrupt much in that on that time scale. And then I have a question actually for Eric as well, which is, if I postulate that this problem just goes away if you increase the mass slope, right, or flatten the mass,
uh-huh.
mass function slope.
That's right.
So the X that I got looking at the white dwarfs, irrespective of the main sequence, the lower main sequence stuff, which could be evaporated, was very much flatter. And doing a back of the envelope estimate, I think you increased the number of neutron stars roughly a factor of 10 over it's, what you had there, which is basically the difference between 10% and 1%, right?
Yeah.
So it might just be a problem that we didn't have the right assumption.
That's right. In my simulations, I did vary the slope and the mass function. But
yes, that's right. Well, sort of, I was thinking of the point in between Brad and Josh, which is Josh is saying, well, what happens if they have time to all get to the center, and then you have this additional ejection mechanism, and Brad is saying, well, they might not have time to get to the center. But then the question is, you know, if in fact there are a significant number of them that don't make it into the center, then these would be coming from quite a different place, and the assumption about what velocity they need to escape now becomes modified.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think this really makes contact with the discussion of day one when you talk about, because this is only, you know, some tens of millions of years after the cluster has formed.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole idea of what the initial conditions are
That's right.
becomes absolutely crucial to this discussion and could, I think, turn this in any direction, basically.
That's why I preface this talk by saying that this problem is very rich in terms of the kinds of problems that it touches on
right.
tangentially.
Mm-hmm. Well, I had two more technical questions. Why don't I ask one of them now, because this goes to the question of whether you can verify some of your assumptions, and that is when you look, you know, there are neutron stars that presumably get ejected from the disk, and we see them as millisecond pulsars or, you know, X-ray binaries in our own halo, and from looking at that velocity, spatial and velocity distribution, can you compare that to what you predict from this model, since these presumably went through, although not capture processes, you're really looking at the primordial population anyway,
yeah.
they would have gone through very similar evolutions to the ones that you've described.
Yeah, the probably the main difference is that these are low mass systems. They're mentioning that. That is, they have low mass companions, and they have started out with intermediate mass companions, but they're still fairly low mass. The kinds of systems that really benefit neutron star retention are the massive binaries that remain after the first supernova explosion. So while the kind of systems you're mentioning sort of tie into this whole global problem, both neutron star kicks and binary evolution, it's not clear that it's going to be that important for retaining neutron stars. Most of the systems that are born with low mass companions, these primordial systems, are ejected from the cluster as a result of the mass loss, much less the kick. The mass loss in that case is very important in the supernova explosion.
So the question I wanted to ask was, I mean, Brad sort of raised it, but I don't think we got a clear answer to it. I mean, if we're only seeing 10% or so of the pulsars, because we're just seeing the top of the radioluminosity function, and you're retaining somewhere between 1 and 10% of these things, what's the implications here for the IMF of the cluster? It seems to me it's going to start to look pretty top-heavy. Is that not true?
I don't think it necessarily has to be the case. I mean, the whole point of this kind of investigation is to see how many single neutron stars you might expect to retain from early times, and then what happens is, of course, anyone's guess in terms of the dynamics. It's not clear that you can tie the current epoch observations very strongly to this early epoch, so I'm not sure how
well,
I mean,
if you're seeing 10, you know, you can do the back of the envelope calculation, and you know,
the only thing I think it implies is that there are many neutron stars.
Up to 10 to the 5 solar masses in high mass stars here.
I'm not sure I see how to make the connection. The only thing I think it implies is that there are large numbers of neutron stars and clusters that we need to account for.
which means large numbers of massive stars in the cluster.
It doesn't have to be a large number. I mean, you can get the requisite retention fractions by having a standard IMF, a saltpeter type IMF.
On this, and also sort of answering Josh's questions, all these things, making the initial mass function extremely top heavy just to get more neutron stars, or making the cluster initially much denser or centrally concentrated, all these things are very dangerous because they will tend to drive exactly the type of thing that Josh had in mind. Mm-hmm. A very quick core collapse where all the massive stars will just go to the center of the cluster and separate from all the other lower mass stars and just drive the core collapse. Now this happens, this has been looked, was predicted by Vishniak in a famous paper 30 years ago, 73, and has been seen now in both direct and body simulations. This will be shown, discussed tomorrow, I think, and in Monte Carlo simulations. And once that happens, I think what's pretty much inevitable is that all these massive stars go into a runaway, and you start forming probably a very massive object, maybe a very massive central black hole. And you've lost all the stars that you were counting on to produce remnants. So you want to avoid that. So it's a little dangerous to push things too much in these directions.
Of course, other people could judge better than I could. It's not clear that you have to push them to extreme limits. Just a bit more concentrated, a bit more massive to start with goes a long way.
Just a couple of comments. First of all, I don't think you have to push these numbers at all. We just did a calculation here that for a Krupa mass function or a Scalo mass function, you expect about 1 in 300 stars to turn into neutron stars. So the 1,000 that you quoted for a million solar mass cluster should really be more like 10,000. Secondly, we've actually done these simulations with these mass functions, which are, I think, reasonable, not pushed at all. And I think the statement that the progenitors of the clusters that we see were at least twice as massive and at most half the size and half mass radius in the distant past is a very reasonable statement.
That's
not
right.
At all unlikely.
Yeah.
And if you combine those two statements, I don't see any problem here at all.
Well, the statement about the IMF, I'm not sure I've followed why that was important. You get 3,000 neutron stars out of that.
Well, you took a million solar mass cluster and said 1,000 neutron stars.
No. That was, I said, the number that you need to retain.
No, I understand.
Yeah, so that's a 30% retention fraction in that particular case.
I thought you needed to retain a few hundred, and that was from 1,000.
No, I think you need
to
retain an order of 1,000. That's my claim. That's what I was trying to claim in that view graph.
Well, the numbers that you start off with are about 10,000, yeah. So I'm not sure that you have to push the IMF very far from standard models.
Maybe true.
Eric, I have a question not so much about the neutron stars that you retain, but about the ones you kick out of the cluster. And I've always had some problems with explaining some of the subpopulations of pulsars in the disk, like, for instance, isolated millisecond pulsars. I think there are too many. But anyway, do you follow or do you worry about the ones you eject, and do they contribute significantly to the population of disk neutron stars?
It all depends on what the retention fraction is and how many you start with. These would be very old. It's not clear what you would see. They would be certainly isolated neutron stars by and large. Some would be tied up in binaries, but they would have 13 billion years to evolve. You'd form LMXBs and every other sort of object that you'd form in the disk in much lower numbers because it's smaller numbers of globular clusters to work with, at least if we take the current epoch as the example. I don't think you would see any remnants of this particular phase at early times in millisecond pulsars or LMXBs or anything else.
So I just wanted to say a few words about the initial conditions. So we are starting to get observational constraints, at least from the cluster formation we see nearby on the actual radial profile. And I think it would be hard to push the initial concentration really far. I don't think that's what we see, and we can get better data for that. Making the IMF, I think losing some fraction of the mass, factor of 10 might be too high, but some fraction is probably almost expected.
Yeah.
But making the IMF a lot more top-heavy really scares me.
That's not something that I particularly favor.
Just in terms of having the clusters stick around, first of all, you have the problem of trying to form all the stars before the supernovae blow the rest of the gas away. Even if you make the star formation happen before any of the supernovae start going off, you still have the problem that's a lot of mass loss, and you generally have this well-known correlation. The more top-heavy the IMF is, the less likely the cluster is to survive at all. So I'd be uncomfortable really tweaking the IMF, and I'd hope that we'll have more constraints on the initial profile, at least for the ones we see today, which hopefully are analogs to the ones we see that happened in the past.
Stein's pretty loud.
Couple of comments. One is there is an example of just the sort of system you invoke, which is a binary pulsar with a high-mass white dwarf companion that would be a descendant from a neutron star and a moderate-mass star that had undergone mass transfer, and it has a low spatial velocity. So it's perfect. It's the example of a system that would be retained in a globular cluster. But the really scary possibility is we don't understand the kick mechanism.
Right.
But plausible kick mechanism can perfectly well correlate with radioluminosity. And we see supernova remnants with no neutron stars or no evidence of black holes. So somewhere between 0 and 50% of all neutron stars being born could be radio quiet when they're young and have low spatial velocities. And in that case, there's a huge channel that's completely wide open. We have no information on until somebody does a very deep X-ray survey and then does it again to get the proper motions.
All right. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to make conclusions based on things we don't see, right? So.
I have more questions or comments.
This is just a question about the parameters that you use, the type of initial mass function, the distribution of binary periods, of mass ratios, and also of binary fraction. Have you done simulations where you've really varied all of these things to see how they influence?
Within reasonable limits, the results don't change by much. I mean, certainly I can change my retention fractions of 5 to 10% to 1 or 2%. By an appropriate adjustment, or I can change them to 10 or 15% by an appropriate adjustment within reason.
So there's basically an order of magnitude that these types of variations.
I don't know about an order of magnitude within what I would call reasonable variations, but certainly factors of a few.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Anything else? Wow, you really stirred up some dust, Eric.
Thank you very much.
I like the talk.